KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
I don't think it's a good thing for our state, and I think it'll expose the most vulnerable in our population, our children, to its harmful consequences.
Allowing the sale through regulated outlets is not going to increase the availability of marijuana.
It's hard to do a short story because every time I try to write something, it just gets longer. Dirt Day is one long story that's connected with lots of different parts of it.
Laurie Anderson talking about storytelling. We'll be talking to her in about half an hour or so. And the pro and con side of marijuana, which we take up right now. Should marijuana be legal and accessible for adults over 21? Initiative 502 would allow for the sale and possession of marijuana. Washington State would be out front in challenging federal marijuana policy. If voters approve 502, there would be a regulatory regime put in place. We take this up from a number of perspectives. We start with Allison Holcomb, campaign director for New Approach Washington and drug policy director for the ACLU of Washington. She supports the passage of Initiative 502. Good to see you again.
Good morning.
Douglas Hyatt is an attorney who has represented medical marijuana patients for more than a decade. He's opposed to the passage of 502. He is working with the Sensible Washington campaign. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Nice to be here.
I appreciate you both being here. Can we start a little bit with a very simple question? What's marijuana?
Ooh, marijuana is the word that we adopted to describe the cannabis plant. It's a plant that has the ability to improve your mood, change your mood. It is smoked, eaten. It's been around for centuries, used medicinally, used for pleasure.
Anything you want to add to that?
It's been found in the pharmacopoeia in China in 4,000-year-old tombs. It's one of the safest natural substances on the planet. It's virtually unique among drugs in that it has no what they call LD50. It has absolutely no lethal dose that a human being can take, which makes it unique. Even water has an LD50. So it's a very unique substance. It is a natural plant. It's an herb. It's also a hemp. It's also a plant that can provide fuel, fiber. You can do anything you can do with a tree. You can do with a hemp plant, except make a guitar out of it. And maybe even that. Yet. Maybe
Yet.
Even that.
All right. So,
but incredibly useful plant, and would be, and it's a shame that we're not growing hemp in this country because we're throwing away a $430 million domestic hemp market largely to the Chinese.
All right. The question before voters, then, is not, in a nutshell, it's not how you folks view the plant, but how you view the state's efforts to regulate it. So Initiative 502, this is what's on the ballot for you. This measure would license and regulate marijuana production, distribution, and possession for persons over 21, removing state law, criminal, and civil penalties for activities that it authorizes, tax marijuana sales, and earmark marijuana-related revenues. And the question is, should this measure be enacted into law? Why should it?
Well, we aren't regulating marijuana right now. Right now, all we have is a prohibition model, which means we just have a blanket, just say no policy. And the idea behind adopting that policy in the first place was that that was somehow going to have an impact on marijuana's use and availability, and that's clearly not been the case. Instead, we've made this plant into an extraordinarily profitable black market commodity. We are depriving ourselves of many of its beneficial uses, and we are depriving ourselves of any tax revenue that we could actually collect and invest in programs and services that would actually have a public health approach and impact on marijuana use.
And why is this a good law? Why is this the good approach to take?
Initiative 502 is a good approach to take because it can pass, first of all, in November of 2012. It basically takes into consideration where the voters right now are on the issues of public safety and public health when it comes to the use of an intoxicant. And it will end somewhere between 9,000 and 10,000 arrests for simple marijuana possession every year. It will allow the state to create a licensing and regulatory system that will bring marijuana out of the black market and under control by private businesses here in the state, and generate, according to the State Office of Financial Management, up to $1.9 billion in the first 5 years after passage.
I want to stick with that first statement you gave me for you, Doug Hyatt. Why isn't this a good measure if it can pass?
Well, I don't know whether it can pass or not, and we'll find that out in November. You'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that supports marijuana legalization more than I do. But this is not the way to do it. In fact, this isn't legalization. This campaign has run essentially what I believe is a big lie. It's a large misdirection to the voters. This does not legalize marijuana. It takes 1 ounce and it makes it not a violation, according to the initiative, and it takes the production stream that they want to see implemented, and it describes it as not a violation. That is not the same as legalization. In addition, you've got what amounts to an illegal transaction. You have to legalize something before you can tax it. You've got a federal law problem. But the worst thing and the worst reason, or the best reason to vote against this, the worst thing this initiative does is make some disastrous changes to our DUI laws that affect young folks, especially the age of 16 to 21. This initiative puts in place a zero tolerance standard for anyone 16 to 21 for driving, and changes the law to make it a per se strict liability offense, which practically means, as a criminal defense attorney, I can't defend you.
All right. This has been the rub, it seems, from your perspective on what's wrong with this law. I want to come back to the other questions, but let's take up that question of legality. So what does the law do, right, if it was passed? What would it do to somebody 16 to 21?
Well, if on a Friday night, if you're out driving, you got a busted taillight or, you know, whatever, probable cause in an automobile doesn't take much for an officer these days. They pull you over. They smell marijuana smoke on somebody in the car. If you're under 21, you're going to the hospital and you're going to have a blood test. If that blood test detects any amount of marijuana in your system under zero tolerance standards, any amount, you're going to have a DUI. I can't defend you. Under the per se standard, I can't go into court and say that you're a chronic user and you've developed a tolerance and you're not impaired. I can't go into court and say you're a medical marijuana patient and you need marijuana and your doctor says so, but I can't defend you even though you're not impaired. That kind of thing, those kind of strict liability laws, and that zero tolerance standard is horribly unfair. It's a new penalty for pot for kids. And if you've got grandkids or if you've got kids 16 to 21, you don't want to vote for this initiative.
Right. So you're saying that any trace of marijuana in a 16-year-old, 21-year-old system is going to register. When does that disappear in your body?
It's not clear to me anyway, because I don't think there's enough good science on this yet. This initiative actually uses active THC in your system. So I believe you're going to have used the marijuana sometime relatively close to the test. But it's not clear how long a detectable amount of marijuana, which means any nanograms, will be detectable in your system. And it's not clear how emerging drug testing equipment, it's not clear, you know, how that's going to affect this.
All right, one last thing, and then I'm going to turn to you. But the rules are going to be written after this initiative is passed. Why can't you work at that level to make sure that if somebody is not impaired,
That's not the way the law works. The rules that they're talking about that'll be written a year later are the rules that deal with production and deal with, you know, the Liquor Control Board promulgating whatever it's going to promulgate.
So you say that what's in here about the safe standards, that's not going to be changed.
It can't be changed for a couple of years under the way the initiatives work, and this makes a change to the DUI laws. You've never seen a headline in the paper that says legislature reduces penalty for stone driving. You know, you're not going to see it. So once you get something like this in place, you're going to be stuck with it. And the problem is,
well, you think.
Well, I think.
I mean, you think the legislature.
I've never seen the laws on driving or anything get liberalized. And the problem is that 95% of our current marijuana arrests occur as a result of traffic stops. So you can easily take 10,000 possession arrests and turn them into 10,000 DUIs.
Right. Well,
you've also changed the law as it relates to adults, and the 5 nanogram standard for adults is simply not scientific, not needed, not accurate, and it's unjust.
All right, we'll come back to that because I want to hear your response as well. Why isn't this a concern for you?
Well, I mean, Douglas's arguments are premised on the assumption that once I-502 passes, law enforcement officers are going to start ignoring the Constitution, ignoring well-established DUI law.
Why do you say that? Because I mean, pulling people over is what they do sometimes. So why is that ignoring the Constitution?
All the time.
Well, because pulling people over has to be based on reasonably articulable suspicion of a violation of law. Arresting you has to be based on probable cause to believe you've committed a crime. Taking you in for either a breath test or a blood test has to be based on specifically evidence that you've been driving while impaired. So there already has to be evidence of impairment before you even get to a breathalyzer. And you don't get to a blood test. And this is under current law, right? Blood tests are how we currently prosecute drugged DUI cases. You can't get, the officer can't take you for a blood test unless they've got not only evidence of impairment, but evidence that that impairment is caused by something other than alcohol.
I thought they were arguing that the smelling the marijuana was enough probable cause to raise questions about impairment.
That's not, it might raise questions about impairment, but the fact that they can smell marijuana doesn't mean, that's not impairment. And under current law, right? It's not impairment. They've got to have some evidence that you were driving while impaired. You could be driving while carrying marijuana in your car and be cited for marijuana possession, but that's not evidence of impaired driving. Moreover, when 502 passes, the smell of marijuana is no longer going to provide probable cause for an offense because it's going to be legal to possess up to an ounce of marijuana. So unless that police officer has separate evidence that suggests that you have more than an ounce of marijuana on you, there's no evidence of any crime being committed.
I know you want to respond. I'll let you respond in a minute, but I just it sounds like if this passes, given that I have two lawyers in the room, there's going to be a lot of legal going back and forth, a lot more legal activity in the system.
Absolutely, just like right now, right? We've had a 0.08.
I mean, it won't be more. It'll be like now?
Well,
it'll be more.
Well, let's just talk about DUI, right? I mean, I personally find it humorous that Douglas says that he can't defend you under a per se standard. There are lots of DUI lawyers in this state right now that are making a good living off of defending people that are blowing higher than a 0.08 on an alcohol DUI. All the defenses are still available. Was there a legal basis to stop you? Was there sufficient evidence of probable cause that you were driving impaired? Was the test administered properly? Did the officer maintain chain of custody? Everything that DUI lawyers do now stays intact. All we're doing is creating a standard for marijuana that is legally analogous to the 0.08 standard for alcohol, and which for people under 21 is 0.02. It's a lower standard for them. And I would just point out that even though the statute 502 has a zero tolerance policy for people under 21, the Washington State Patrol Toxicology Lab says that in practical reality, that's going to be one nanogram because they don't submit tests below one nanogram as evidence. So basically, what Douglas is painting here is a picture of this world in which everything we know about DUI law enforcement gets turned on its head. And I just don't think that's realistic.
That's just completely untrue. this is the whole thing. First of all, the notion that this is going to change the probable cause standard is totally untrue. And we have a state Supreme Court case called State versus Fry that came out a couple of years ago in January and basically said, no, changes in the medical marijuana law aren't, the fact that it's defensible doesn't change the probable cause standard. This initiative doesn't legalize anything. It makes it not a violation, okay? It makes it not a violation. It doesn't legalize marijuana. It leaves on the books every single law that makes marijuana illegal currently is left on the books by this initiative. You go into the marijuana store, you get your little ounce of marijuana, you come out and hand it to me, you've committed a delivery of a controlled substance.
Yes.
Those are the kind of absurd results that you can get when you don't do complete comprehensive reform.
So is that why you don't like it?
That's one of the many reasons why I don't like it. I also don't like it because it's completely preemptible and it's going to be wiped out in federal court in about 5 minutes. But let's get back to the DUI stuff because that's important.
You have all of a minute to do
this. This does change the DUI standard. It does make a difference. I can't defend you if you're a patient. I can't call a doctor in. I can't give evidence. I can't put on a case that says you're not impaired because the standard's been determined. You test at it, you're convicted. It's just that simple.
How come you guys have such a difference of opinion on this?
Well,
Well, it's
this is like categorically
I'll tell you,
different.
It's very clear what the difference is. And unfortunately, I can tell you this campaign has misled people from the very beginning. The entire advertising campaign on this campaign is misleading. This doesn't legalize anything. It made significant changes to the DUI. Because they want it to pass. They put these DUI provisions in here to pander to people's fears. Because they're spending millions of dollars running a legalization campaign that isn't a legalization campaign, and they're hoping it works.
I mean, they're just confused about
lawyers that have signed on as sponsors and endorsers are just confused about
signing on. Many of the people that signed on haven't even read.
You guys can't do that. So I'll do this. Let's take a break. We'll come back.
Good morning, it's 9:20. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. We have clouds and rain in Seattle, 58 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for clouds and rain all day today, the high in the upper 50s. Clouds and rain tonight, breezy, the low in the mid-40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Soil Logic Landscaping, utilizing Seattle's maritime climate to provide landscape design for autumn installations and renovation. More on fine garden care at soillogiclandscaping.com. Creative solutions for Puget Sound landscapes.
Still to come on the program this hour, we'll talk with musician and performance artist Lori Anderson. She's in town with a new solo show called Dirt Day. She joins us in 15 minutes.
Initiative Measure 502 concerns marijuana. The question on the ballot will be, this measure would license and regulate marijuana production, distribution, and possession for persons over 21, remove state law criminal and civil penalties for activities that it authorizes, tax marijuana sales, and earmark marijuana-related revenues. Should this measure be enacted into law? It's the question you're facing. We're getting some positions on the law itself, the proposal itself. Norm Stamper is a former chief of Seattle Police Department. He's author of a book called Breaking Rank, a Top Cop's Exposé of the Dark Side of American Policing. He's involved with the group Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Norm Stamper, thanks for talking to us again.
Pleasure to be with you.
And Peter Bensinger is a Chicago-based attorney who served on the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency Administration as the administrator from 1976 to 1981. Peter Bensinger, thank you for talking to us.
I'm happy to be on this program. Having listened to what is said, I have some comments.
All right, we'll start with those.
I'm not an attorney.
Oh, well, then I'm going to take that off the bio.
Better, it wasn't on the bio. I got an honorary law degree, but it was given for distinguished service, not for legal studies.
All right. What do you call yourself?
I call myself a 76-year-old recovering bureaucrat that served in both Democratic and Republican administrations, and would say to your viewers that this law has no chance of being put into effect, even if it passes.
Because
it's against the Constitution, it's against the Controlled Substances Act, and it's against Supreme Court decisions that have already looked at situations where state law and federal law conflict. And when they do, the federal law is supreme. This was just evidenced in the Arizona immigration case. And the last speaker, the lawyer that was kind of complaining about the legalization, said in about 5 minutes, the federal law will preempt it. He's exactly right, because the Justice Department has already gone on record when California had a Proposition 19 proposing to have no penalties for the sale, distribution, or growth of marijuana.
All right, let's leave that as a given, and let me ask you something, because I only have 5 minutes with each of you. Why should it remain illegal, marijuana?
Well, first of all, it's a major public health problem. It's got 468 chemicals, 60% more cancer-causing agents than tobacco. It affects today in the workplace in Seattle. If any of your workers at Boeing, any of your bus drivers, your train conductors want to start smoking marijuana, they'd be fired. It affects judgment, depth perception, vision, short-term memory. The idea that you're going to have no arrests is ridiculous. The biggest users of marijuana are age 12 to 25. All these young kids, if this were to pass, would be buying pot off the street, and they'd be arrested because they're under 21. Third, you'd have a major problem with thinking you're going to get any tax revenue, because 881C, the U.S. code, allows you to forfeit any money derived from traceable to a violation of the Controlled Substances Act. And selling marijuana and getting money for it would be a felony under federal law. So the state of Washington is not going to get any $1 billion. They're not going to get any money from this.
The Liquor Control Board agencies will get arrested by federal agents?
The federal agents took an oath of office, and I used to administer them, to uphold the law. And when someone is seen selling, even if it's a state agency, a controlled substance and getting money for it, that's not, the state is not going to keep that dough. The federal government will collect it.
By the way, you were saying, you were making those statements about young people and also the use of it by crane operators and the like. Can't it be used in a recreational setting and still have some regulation for people who would be in public safety?
Marijuana, unlike alcohol, is fat soluble. It stays in the body a long time, days, even weeks. So people that use marijuana, unless they stop for 3 weeks, will generally test positive in a drug test because it goes to the fatty tissue of the body, which is the brain, the liver, the kidneys, unlike alcohol, which dissolves in about one drink an hour.
All right, let me get Norm Stamper to react to that. Norm Stamper, we'll come back to the federal preemption issue in a minute. Marijuana stays in your body. It's going to be impairing people who are going to be in the public sphere. It shouldn't be legalized.
100 million Americans, Steve, have tried marijuana at least once. That includes the last three presidents, including one who famously did not inhale. There is evidence to suggest that there are 17 to 25 million Americans who smoke marijuana regularly. What Mr. Bensinger is describing is the existing state of conditions. That is to say, marijuana being illicit subjects people, obviously, to arrest. And I find it interesting that those who are marijuana drug law violators are on exactly the same side as those who are marijuana drug law enforcers when it comes to prohibition. And prohibition is really at the heart of this argument. It was not the federal government that decided to end our hopelessly failed policy of alcohol prohibition from 1920 to 1933. It was the states. And the state of New York decided, okay, this is enough of this nonsense. The lost revenue, the more dangerous, unhealthy conditions in our cities. We're going to end prohibition. And if the feds want to come in and enforce alcohol laws, the state said, be our guest.
What do you say to New York had
made that position known, other states began to fall into place, and I think that's exactly what we're going to be seeing here. The states are incubators for creative solutions to long-standing problems. And this marijuana prohibition, decades old, has certainly caused more harm than good.
So that's your answer to the preemption. What do you say to the people who are arguing that the drug itself shouldn't be legalized because it's not good for people?
Well, I'm not an advocate of marijuana or alcohol or tobacco, and I think it's critical that we keep marijuana out of the hands and the bodies of our young people.
You think this legalization would do it?
We have great use among 12 to 25-year-olds, particularly on the higher end of that range. People need to understand that marijuana, tobacco, alcohol do cause problems with a developing brain. So it's critical that we take steps to reduce accessibility. Currently, it's easier for kids to score marijuana than alcohol. And every cop can tell you stories about that. So it's important, I think, to understand that that we need to recognize what is currently the reality and how most effectively to change it so we get safer and healthier communities.
Why do you think that this regime would take marijuana out of the hands of young people? Why wouldn't it just make it easier for young people to get their friend who's over 21 to buy it for them and hand it to them the way they get liquor?
Well, I'll make a public confession here. I did that same thing with liquor when I was a kid. There's no guarantee that that's not going to happen. But under a regulatory system, you create a situation in which the government, imperfect though it may be, is administering all those provisions of the regulatory system, which means that there will be supervision, there will be tests, there will be monitoring of the facilities to ensure that the so-called marijuana stores are not selling to minors. There's no law that is perfect. There is no way to guarantee that marijuana sold legally in a store to an adult does not get passed along to a child. It is important to point out, however, that the penalty for doing that is going to be very, very stiff.
All right. Norm Stamper and Peter Bensinger, I appreciate you both. We wanted to get a law enforcement perspective into this discussion. I appreciate that. Peter Bensinger is a 76-year-old recovering bureaucrat with the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency. And Norm Stamper is a former police chief and involved with the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition group. So, Doug Hyatt, you heard, I want to get your reaction to what Peter Bensinger said about marijuana. Let's leave the federal question aside for a minute. You're on the same side with the folks who say marijuana doesn't belong in anybody's hands.
I am not on the same side with Peter Bensinger. I am not on the side.
But I mean,
of
in terms of this initiative,
I am not on the. I'm not on that side. If this initiative did what Mr. Stamper, whom I have great respect for, if this initiative did what Mr. Stamper said it would do, which is repeal, if what he's talking about are initiatives based on repeal, the 1932 repeal of Bone Dry Act in this state. Some other lawyers drafted a different initiative, and you can find it at sensiblewashington.org, which does do exactly what Norm Stamper is talking about. And he endorsed that initiative, by the way, which repeals all the criminal and civil penalties under state law and is preemption proof. That initiative I support.
How is it preemption proof? Real quick.
It's preemption proof because it essentially does exactly the same thing that happened during Prohibition. It simply removes all marijuana law from the state law and makes it silent, and that way you're not in conflict with the federal government. It's the tried and true and proven way to end Prohibition.
Well, why don't you folks do that in order to avoid this controversy?
Because it's not politically viable. I mean, what we're talking about here is you're taking every criminal and civil penalty off the books. So anybody
for marijuana.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about. And so anybody could grow it. They could sell it to anybody that they wanted to. They could deliver it to anybody they want to. They could do it anyway. You'd have absolutely no restrictions on it, right?
No.
So until you have
not,
a regulatory
that's not true.
System.
Well, let her finish.
Until
saying.
You have a regulatory system in place, that's exactly what could happen. So what we did was we drafted something that said this is what we could make it look like. And I think it's interesting that Peter Bensinger brought up the Arizona immigration law, because at the same time that that was being litigated, Arizona's medical marijuana act was being litigated. And it was the U.S. Department of Justice that came in and filed a successful motion to dismiss that litigation, arguing that it had never threatened to arrest or indict any state employee for administering the licensing and regulation of marijuana.
All right, you wanted to respond, then I have a quick question about medical stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, this campaign, again, is doing another thing,
which is
confusing the whole issue of whether medical marijuana is federally preemptible from whether legalization or whatever this does, not a violation, is preemptible. There's a difference there. Federal preemption doesn't apply to medical marijuana. The case is San Diego Normal, and federal preemption is going to apply to this. It's simply a different basis for federal preemption analysis, and
that's the thing you lawyers are going to argue. I want to right. I mean, we don't know that yet.
Pretty settled, and I don't think it. I think what we're going to wind up with is 1 ounce decrimmed, nowhere legal to buy it, and those disastrous changes to our DUI laws that I was talking about. That's what you're going to wind up with when the federal courts get done with this.
Under this law, is there an impact on medical marijuana in our medical marijuana system or medical marijuana use?
I don't know. It'd be difficult at this point for me to tell. I don't know. I don't think it will have a tremendous impact. It could.
Beyond the question of what you talked about, people being pulled over.
I think the DUI
but otherwise,
will have a disastrous effect for patients. Essentially, it criminalizes their driving.
What do you know? Will it have a medical marijuana impact?
It has absolutely no impact on the Medical Use of Cannabis Act. Everything that is currently legal under that act remains legal. Plus, because of the decriminalization of possession of an ounce, patients will finally get protection from arrest if they don't possess more than that.
By the way, on the question that Peter Bensinger raised about collecting monies, you think there'll be no problem?
Absolutely.
There will be a problem.
The Washington State Department of Revenue collected $750,000 in sales tax from about 50 dispensaries last year. California and Colorado collect millions of dollars. The notion that the federal government is going to come in and try to take tax dollars out of the hands of a state is laughable.
And you'd say?
I think that's just not true. Again, we're talking about medical marijuana, and we're talking about taxes and whether there's a tax basis allowed for medical marijuana, which is a different thing entirely than this, which purports to legalize recreational, and it's just a different thing. The fact that anybody is paying taxes on marijuana in this state, I hope, will end. I have a lawsuit against the city of Seattle, which I hope will resolve a lot of these questions. People are under the impression that it's somehow marijuana is legal now. Medically, it is not. Marijuana is illegal all the time, 24 hours a day. What you have is a very narrow exception. It is an affirmative defense, and I can go to court and explain your behavior, and then it's excused. But marijuana is not legal for any purpose.
All right, let me ask one last question and be kind of quick on it. Perfect as the enemy of the good. So why isn't – let me ask you first. Why is this good if it's got all these problems with it? Why not have created a law that would have had less opposition from the people who support the idea?
Initiative 502 is perfect because it can pass on November 6, 2012. It will strike the first blow, not the last blow, but the first blow against marijuana prohibition. And like all other laws on the books, this issue is going to evolve over time.
And what's your answer to that?
It's perfect because it can pass.
Well,
I mean, that's just ridiculous. This is a badly drafted initiative that won't survive federal preemption, that is going to result in the arrests of thousands of kids and have disastrous DUI consequences for them. This isn't good. I mean, I'm sick of hearing that perfect is the enemy of the good stuff, but if this was good, I wouldn't be opposing it. If this was going to create a big problem, I wouldn't be opposing it. I'm opposing it because it's incredibly unfair, and it's going to result in the arrests of a lot of kids. And if you don't think that those kids are going to be kids of color primarily, or that it's going to disproportionately fall on kids of color, then you're just not in the real world anymore. This will have disastrous real-world consequences.
Right. Because you brought that up, I just have to – the last debate I was at, Reverend Leslie Braxton said, you know, the problem is that right now we have a regime where too many kids of color are being arrested, and at least this will have some impact.
I wish it would. I wish it would. I couldn't agree with the Reverend more. And, you know, I participated in the study that Harry Levine and Lauren Siegel did recently that talks about the cost of marijuana arrests. Like I said earlier, you couldn't find anybody, you know, that's more in favor of changing our marijuana policies. It's just, this is just not the way to do it.
All right. I gave him more time, so you want the last word on that? Kids of color.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's what's happening right now. They're three times as likely to be arrested and charged. And if 502 is not passed, we're looking at another year of another 10,000 arrests, another 3,200 convictions, all those people saddled with convictions. Mr. Hyatt's arguing for the status quo, and it's time to give up on the status quo.
All right, we'll leave it there. Allison Holcomb is campaign director for New Approach Washington, supporting Initiative 502. Douglas Hyatt is opposing it. He also works for Sensible Washington Campaign. Find out more. You have your voters' guides. You can find out a lot of information. Thank you both. This is Weekday.
So when Steve was a little boy, he said, Daddy, what do you do for work? And Pops,
he took out a little piece of paper, and he wrote, S-P-Y.
My dad's a spy.
On the next Snap Judgment from PRX and NPR, we go deep undercover. Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Always a fantastic hour of storytelling. Snap Judgment, Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Good morning, it's 9:39. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information. I'm Andy Hurst.
Support for KUOW comes from the state of Montana, a place where ski areas, pristine mountains, and giant snowfalls create a playground that captures the essence of the outdoors. Winter vacation planning tools at wintermt.com.
KUOW and Seattle Arts and Lectures present Hari Kunzru, British essayist, journalist, and author of four novels, including Gods Without Men, at Benaroya Hall on Tuesday, October 23rd. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
We have clouds and light rain in Seattle, 58 degrees in the University District. We're expecting clouds and showers all day today, the high in the upper 50s. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight, the low in the mid-40s, cloudy tomorrow with just a chance of rain, tomorrow's high reaching 50.
Support for KUOW comes from the Master Builders Association Remodeled Homes Tour, featuring 21 projects throughout King and Snohomish counties. Remodelers for each project will be on site to answer questions. More information at remodeltour.com.
That's music from Laurie Anderson from her latest show, Dirt Day. Laurie Anderson is a pioneer of contemporary American music and performance. Dirt Day is the third and last in her series of solo story works, which included Happiness and the End of the Moon. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
Grew out of the national fear of this as a response to the national fear that grew out of 9/11, Dirt Day. That's what I read right there. Is that how you interpret it too?
Interpret it? Well, no.
Explain it? How about explain it?
Explain it. I'm trying so hard not to explain stuff, but...
Yes, I noticed that.
Describe
it? I noticed that. All right, describe it.
Okay. I would describe this as a series of kind of jump cut stories. I'm really interested in the way stories kind of link to each other. And so I'm kind of like a short story person, really. So they are stories from all kinds of worlds, the world of politics and anthropology and dreams, and sort of in the middle of it, there's also a kind of long journalistic, let's say, report about tent cities.
Yes. All right. I'll tell you what. Jump cuts, short stories. Somebody just tuned in the last 10 minutes of this radio. They went from a heated debate about marijuana policy and how the federal government and the state government treats its citizens to this conversation. What's the story connection in there? I give you that charge. Is there a story in there?
I think there is, and I think there's we're all in some ways descendants of our great writers like Melville. Oh, Melville, the way he might tell a story about marijuana and electronic performance art would be just to hook them together. Here he is starting a book. He's saying, "Hello, I'm a guy who'd like to go to sea, but if I did, what would I do there? I guess I could be a captain, except I hate bossing people around. I could be a first mate, but, you know, I don't like swapping the decks. You know what? I could be a cook, because who doesn't like chicken? I love chicken. Hey, and the Egyptians loved chicken. You could see it from the mummies of their roasted river horse and chickens and their giant bakehouses, the pyramids." This is page three of Moby Dick.
Yes, may I say that it sounds like he was. It sounds like he was smoking marijuana when he started writing that book.
The marijuana of, you know, the way our minds can jump, you know. So from Nantucket to ancient Egypt. So I think this way of telling stories is a really great one. I mean, when you think of like how narrative works, you know, our lives don't work that much like that either. You know, they don't have plots. Maybe your life has a plot, does it?
No, my life, however, just to answer this question in a way that I want to hear you respond to, my life for 2 hours has a clock.
Yeah, and that's a kind of...
it's a structure.
Yeah, but it's not a plot. There's no way a clock can be a plot. It's just cutting it up into little segments. And one of the things I'm working on right now is a kind of piece of software that is a a kind of language machine. And it started out when the Kronos Quartet asked me to write some music for them. They're a really wonderful quartet. They have great chops. They're really amazing musicians. And they said, but we'd like to tell stories. And I said, well, but you play so well. How about you just play? And I'll tell you what, I'll write a machine that tells stories from your music. And really? I was like, wait a second, do I know how to do that? Not really very well. But I've been working on some software so that as they play, the sounds trigger with great precision these words, and they are projected in big sort of scale in the concert, in the performance of this music, which is a kind of, let's call it, multimedia thing.
So, I mean, I see the words.
You see the words. And it's a different relationship of text to music that I'm finding really exciting because it's about, it's so fast.
Is it
so
random?
Precise. No, these are stories that it might be randomized later as I work on it, but right now it's just a way to tell a story with music and chop it up in rhythmic ways that are different. It also is a, when those written texts are triggered not by music but by a spoken story, what I find fascinating is they begin by being a one-on-one transcription of what you're saying, and then they slowly depart into other alphabets. And as you read what is different from what you're hearing, I've just noticed that, you know, we are meaning machines. We're looking for meaning everywhere. We need to make connections and find resonances. And so you actually have the feeling that you're reading these abstract symbols and they're making sense.
You know, you said, Laurie Anderson, who was our guest, you said meaning machines there, and it's something that I've been thinking about. Another charge I can give you. It seems that everybody, I'm going to make it the whole world, is talking about story and storytelling, and that we are storytellers, and that is there a danger that the storytelling aspect becomes fetishized, that that's what is important rather than analysis, rather than understanding?
We are engaged in both right now as we analyze the debates, because these guys, our politicians, are telling us stories. These are just stories about how they see, they're storytellers. How do they see the past? How do they see the future? It's words, piles of words that create stories about who they believe they are and who they believe we are. And so now, as listeners, we actually have to kind of go, is that just, what's the difference right there in that word between fiction and, let's say, Detroit going bankrupt? And okay, just analyze that phrase and analyze the tone of voice. We're looking at stories, the way we look at our own stories. You need stories to live your life. You tell yourself stories so you can get through life, which is really hard to do.
But do I need the – I think that's great you mentioned politicians as storytellers. I've heard you say that a few times, and I was thinking about the stories that Mitt and Barack are telling us. Let's take that, Detroit going bankrupt. Do we need – don't we need the knowledge behind that if we are to actually – know the truth
totally
behind the stories.
And you know, need to know the tone of voice, and you need to know whether the guy is smirking or not, you know, and is that a joke or what? Even if you take, forget bankrupt, let's take a word like cat. If you say the word cat to people, as many people as there are, there will be that many cats that spring to their minds, you know, and so you can't really, without context, do anything in this world and without tone. So that's why watching the way these guys moved, for example, in their last debate was really crucial to – we're very good at interpreting body language and is the guy lying or not, you know, so.
You think we are? Are we good in the debates?
Yeah,
we are.
We are. I think we are.
How about in the ads, which are also stories, and they're very finely and honed stories?
Yeah, I think you have less defenses in an ad because of the way that – it moves in the calculated way that it but I think people know how to read ads also, you know, that's just ad language or ad style, Yeah. We're really pretty sophisticated, I think.
All right. I want to take you back just to the beginning for a little bit here. To the beginning for us, not for you. This is a little bit from Oh Superman.
Oh Superman. Oh Jama. If you want to leave a message, just start talking at the sound of the tone.
Laurie Anderson, you closed your eyes and you were listening intently. After all these years, you still listen intently to that song from, what, 1980?
Yeah.
What are you hearing?
I hear that maybe once every 4 years or something. First of all, I do not sit around listening to it. The idea of listening to my own music is pretty much a form of torture. In this case... Because I'm considering right now writing a sort of sequel to that piece. It has another kind of interest to me. I mean, that song is called "Oh Superman," written really about a political event, about the rescue of the hostages.
The attempted rescue.
The attempted rescue, and it really is. It's about power, and it's about failure. And it's about technology, and it's about the fact that in certain ways that will not save you. So it's a kind of dark song. It's a Shaggy Dog song. It has many, many aspects to it in terms of electronics and what is power. So it invokes, first of all, mom and dad, and then a judge. It's based on a piece by Massenet, which was called "Au Souverain," which was "Au Sovereign / Savior" kind of thing. It's a prayer. It's a prayer for help.
I remember when it came out; it was mind bending for a young person or a middle aged person. Laurie Anderson is one of today's premier performance artists, known primarily for her multimedia presentations. She's a photographer, a filmmaker, a poet, a painter, electronics whiz, vocalist. You asked me if there was a narrative, and of course there isn't in my life. Can we look at your art and hear a narrative or see a narrative?
Well,
an arc?
I keep thinking I'm doing new things, and I look back at some older work and I go, wait a second, I did that exact same thing slightly in another shape. And I'm thinking now of some of the things that I have over at the Henry Gallery, which is a show of books. And when they asked me to do a show, an exhibition here, I said, what kind of space was it? They said, it used to be a bookshop. And of course, now we have lots of spaces that used to be a bookshop, used to be a record shop. What are we doing with these? So what do you do with those? So I thought, well, I've never put all the books I've made together. I wonder if I have some. And it turns out I have like 45 books that are, you know.
That you've constructed.
Yeah. So, and some of them are just that I made for myself, and some of them were just limited edition things, and some of them were published by companies and all sorts. It's a really crazy assortment. So when I look at that, I see in a weird way lots of continuity and lots of themes that are kind of running through here and there. I don't know if you can genuinely do something new. I make a big effort to jump out of my style because it's a trap.
Well, I like this line that you wrote. This is about midway through Dirt Day. The main goal is to end life with a certain amount of precision and the least amount of mess. How are you doing on that? Not that your life is ending, but how are you doing on cleaning things up?
I'm a mess. I'm a mess like all of us. You know, it's just when you try to tailor it and shape it up, it just becomes so plasticky, you know. So, and I don't mind that life is a mess. I think... You know, it's like when people say they don't believe in God, but they believe in science, because it's like to say something like that in a funny way is like, how could you believe in something that's constantly changing? Believe in science? It's suddenly, you know, it's not string theory anymore at all. So you're believing in what? You're believing in the fact that everything is changing every single second. So that's how I try to accept the what could seem like chaos, but for me is colorful and interesting and beautiful and kind of borderline insane.
So you just answered that, but so then I think you answered this, but I'll ask again. So what do you believe in at this point? Borderline insanity.
I believe I'm going to have to figure this out because I was just got a commission from Arte TV in France to do a film on my philosophy. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't have a philosophy. So now they said, well, just do it on your anti-philosophy. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Laurie Anderson's going to give a talk, Technology, Art, Dreams, at 6:30 at Kane Hall. That's at capacity, but there'll be a standby line. Her performance or appearance at Meany Hall, 8 p.m. is sold out, but there's a waiting list. You're very popular. And then Sunday at noon at Intimon Theater, Women Acting Out. Local artists explore the role of art in civic action, which I believe we just sort of touched on today, did we not?
A little bit.
Thank you very much.
It's been fun.
This is Weekday.
This is the
sound of the week.
Of the week.
The week.
Yes,
of
the sound of the week.
Monday is garbage day for weekday listener Susan in West Seattle. Every garbage day, her neighbor's giant Tom Turkey alerts her to the arrival of the garbage and recycling trucks. She says she's not sure if he's warning her or greeting the trucks as a fellow noisy gorgeous creature. Turkeys in West Seattle. She says sirens and helicopters are equally exciting for the old Tom. Thank you, Susan, for sending that in. What about you? What are you hearing? Send us a sound. Weekday at KUOW.org. Record 30 seconds of it. Put sound of the day in the subject line. Nick Bond, how are you?
Pretty good, thanks.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist, works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. How's it look this weekend?
Well, definitely on the cool, showery side. A cold front has just moved through the coast. It's actually the temperatures dropped down from 58 to last night to 50 now, and that cool air is knocking on the door. And so we're going to have widespread showers around. May be shadowed a bit right in the Seattle area, but certainly the mountains are going to get a fair amount. And with that cooler air, snow levels are definitely going to be dropping from 7,000 or 8,000 feet now to 3,000 feet by later today, tonight, and into the weekend.
So we got this cool, showery weather regime is here. How does flooding look?
Well, nothing too alarming, on the way. We are getting into the flood season, and so we're keeping an eye on that. But this isn't the kind of Pineapple Express type situation. This is more a very cool air mass that coming out of the Gulf of Alaska and just kind of almost stationary low that's just flinging showers over us from time to time through kind of the middle of the week.
You know, Nick, you mentioned something here which is fascinating. We got these floods that occur when rain falls. We get floods across 101. Sometimes salmon follow them across the road. But also rivers flood, as we know, because of the kind of logging that's gone on and the change in the forest. But you say there's an additional effect because of the increase in alder.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm talking in particular about the Skokomish River, and that's the one that floods across 101 near Shelton or Potlatch or whatever, and this chum salmon cross the road there. And so the clear cutting that has gone in that, taken place in that watershed has put sediment in the channel, and that helps make it flood so often. But it also, that alder fixes nitrogen out of the atmosphere, and it can kind of recolonize an area because it has that ability to do that. And ultimately what happens is the runoff then is has more nutrients that fuels algal blooms in Hood Canal. When those algal blooms decompose, that draws down oxygen levels and you get fish kills. And so it shows an example of how, you know, elements of our environment are all kind of linked to one another.
That's remarkable. Links upon links. You know, we had that report about Hood Canal, and they were saying, well, maybe it's not septic tanks. But it is, in some ways, perhaps, if it's not septic tanks, still human actions and interactions. That's
right.
Amazing. All right, Nick, I appreciate the weather forecast and a little science there.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Later.
Later. Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works for the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, working with scientists from all over the region and the area. Joins us every Friday to give us a little bit of science insight into the weather. Stay with us. We'll review the news of the week.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.